over time, yes, it's a good reminder that nothing is safer than renewable energy. I mean, you could, I suppose, drive a tank across Central Europe and get out and smash each of the solar panels with a hammer, but it would take a hell of a long time.
Finally, carbon emissions and war, Bill.
Well, I mean, look, it's carbon, you know, doing anything on this scale is obviously produces a lot of carbon emissions. But the real problem is that it underwrites the constant efforts of the fossil fuel machine, the day in, day out production of fossil fuel. That's what we have a chance here to knock off its pedestal. This is a moment that we should seize in all seriousness in order to take on the two huge existential plagues that face us this morning. The climate crisis outlined in this new IPCC report, and the fact that we have a madman with nuclear weapons who's used the revenues from oil and gas to intimidate and terrify the entire world.
Bill McKibben, I want to thank you for being with us, author, educator, environmentalist, co-founder of 350.org. We'll link to your pieces. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe, all.
This is KBOO.
KBOO is looking for a next membership director. KBOO's members are the heart and soul of our community, and we need a dedicated person to honor and foster this relationship. Are you the right person to steward and manage KBOO's membership department, or do you know someone who is? Then go to kboo.fm to learn more about the essential functions of the membership director and the qualifications we are looking for. To apply, please email your resume and cover letter to hiring@kboo.org by Sunday, March 6th at midnight. You can also apply by mailing your resume and cover letter to KBOO Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. Members make KBOO happen.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, board meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month starting at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Good morning. I'm looking and trying to say, Celeste, are you going to start or am I going to start?
I'm just like you. I'm looking at the engineer instead of it's you. Well, I guess we both start. Good morning. Good morning, everyone. You are listening to your Community Connection, KBOO Portland. 90.7 here in the Portland metropolitan area, 104.3 in Point South along the Willamette River Gorge, or Valley, okay. Let me get my geography correct here. And in the Gorge, the Columbia River Gorge, it's 91.9. Everywhere else in the world, it is kboo.fm. Welcome to an evening of Afrotainment.
A morning of more talk radio.
I was doing good until my phone went off and I got, I got to put my phone on stun here.
Right.
And the brain just left. Boy, how fragile we humans are in our attention spans.
So this is more talk radio.
Yes, it is.
Monday, the 28th of February 2022.
Yeah, it is.
And you are listening to two of us. I'm Cecil and
I'm Celeste.
And we are grateful to be here this morning and have the opportunity to chat and also solicit your opinions and thoughts. You can write down our phone numbers to call us in a bit.
You should put
it
on speed dial.
503-231-8187.
That's right. 8187. And that'll get you into the conversation. Well, first we took President's Day off, you know, and before that, Cecil, you kind of picked up on the conversation we had had the week prior, and some of the elements, I guess, that we're touching are connected, and I don't know, maybe the rest of them aren't, but we thought it was really kind of time to talk about this whole idea of what we expect out of our police officers and the union and this new contract. I don't know how many people logged on to the listening session that Mayor Wheeler and Commissioner Hardesty had last week. And talked about the concerns that they had about the new contract and what language they wanted considered, you know, what points that they want considered. And so now we have a tentative agreement. I think, is it a tentative agreement?
Oh, did they?
No, I think they ratified the contract.
Yeah, did the city council ratify it?
Well... Let's see. I was following it too until, okay, according to the last article I had read, is that they have a tentative agreement. Okay, I was right. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. So, and it's been more than a year of negotiations, as you can imagine, because, well, Portland police don't have a sterling reputation. You know, just cut to the chase and say what needs to be said. And a lot of points were brought up, concerns about accountability, measures for retention, standards of conduct, you know, those kinds of things. And so I thought it would be interesting to hear how people felt about this. One of the things that really matters is the ability for the union to affect items that really should not be negotiable items, like body-worn cameras, for example. The fact that the union provides, unfortunately, a challenge, a barrier, yeah, that's the word I want, a barrier to assessing an officer's performance and putting them in some kind of remedial situation, which could include just termination, you know, just firing if it's a certain type of offense. And so as a rule, the progressive community looks to the whole concept of union to protect people, but that is not necessarily the goal of a union for police. They sometimes have contracts and language that stipulate actions and processes that are harmful to people. In other words, they protect the bad officers when they should really be trying to uphold the good ones instead. But that's just one of the topics we wanted to talk about. I wanted to get your feelings on this new contract and what you think is going to come of it. You know, some of us are a little bit skeptical. Some of us are very optimistic and hopeful, you know. And I'm curious as to whether or not this makes you feel like Portland is moving in the right direction or not. What you are hoping to see happen with this new contract and this new energy. And then speaking of new energy, the other thing we talked about, actually I heard Amy speaking to today, and that is Ketanji Brown.
Who is Ketanji?
Well, okay, I was trying to do the laser look at you so you would feel me.
Oh, I see.
Looking at you. We're in separate rooms due to COVID precautions, y'all. And considering the fact that I was also off because I've been re-exposed, you know, we're trying to really stick with these precautions. And so that's why Cecil and I seem just a tad disjointed. We might be in the same building now, but we're still separated.
So you're referring to the president's nomination of Ketanji Brown Jackson to the Supreme Court, or Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson to the Supreme Court?
Yes.
Currently serving as a federal judge in the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit.
I think you said it right the first time.
It is. So he nominated her this past week, and I suppose today or this week she'll begin the courtesy calls to senators, and then at some point there will be a hearing and I'll vote.
Of course. We hope that it will be, whatever the outcome is, we hope that will be beneficial, because right about now the USA needs some good news and good energy, some fresh ideas. But of course, you know, you've got people like, you know, Tucker Carlson already losing his mind, you know, and he's upset about past comments made by her.
Well, I
know, who I cares?
Not to talk about
who cares. Yeah.
You know, it will. I think I'm kind of exciting because we'll have someone who has the experience of being a public defender.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this in the rarefied world of the judiciary, that is a rare quality and experience to have. Someone who has been a public defender, an actual trial experience. Oh.
Well, okay. So, what do we want to talk about Ketanji Brown Jackson?
Well, many things. In terms of qualifications, in terms of whether or not, what do you think she might bring to the Supreme Court? Is this an appointment that is needed? And how do you think the Senate will respond to her appointment or her nomination? Now, just last year, she was confirmed by the U.S. Senate, so they know who she is, and she was confirmed, I guess, in these times, you call it bipartisan when you have one or two member of the opposite party joining the majority party. So when she was nominated and she was voted on by the Senate, three Republican senators supported her last nomination. And the question might be, will people such as, will they all support her now, or will it be a strict party line vote? And as I said, you know, there was a time when Supreme Court justices usually had a supported by overwhelmingly bipartisan, but in recent years it has been for the most part it has been partisan,
highly partisan.
Yeah, so the last president, when he nominated three, can you believe it?
Yeah,
nominated three persons on the Supreme Court. They were receive opposition from a lot of members on the opposite side, and more, I suppose this will also happen this time.
Well, the numbers are 503-231-8187. Give us a call. If you don't think these are sexy topics, I can appreciate that. But, you know, here's the thing. You're going to be hearing from them, and don't you want to be getting your ideas and information out into the public so that, you know, we can have a shift in the collective consciousness, huh? Sure you do. Sure you do. You know, we want to hear from you. So, I want to shift gears a little bit and reverse back or turn back to discussion about the contract. And so, you know, as I said, there's a lot of layers to that whole dynamic. It's not just about getting a contract that works for both the people who live here in the Portland area, the police. It's about the whole dynamic of interactions with labor unions, like I said, who for the progressive, you know, folks are supposed to be heroes, you know, supposed to be the good guys, you know, and the challenges of having a union kind of hamstring communities across the country in terms of having a level of proficiency and compassion and professional dignity, et cetera, you know, and consequences for not just not meeting the standards, but for breaking the public trust in such egregious ways. I mean, let's be honest. Our police bureau has good people in it, but it also has some people that have caused grievous harm and death to folks in our community, as well as a reluctance to own those mistakes and those harms, and has a federal suit brought against them for abuse of power, you know, use of force, excessive use of force. So you would think that the union, as so-called arbiters of justice for the progressive community, would do a better job of keeping their people in a positive light and willingly standing up to be held accountable. So we have challenges because they ask for things which seem reasonable, but, you know, fly in the face of, you know, even scientific evidence. What you talking about, Celeste? Well, one of the challenges, you know, is that we're trying to get body-worn cameras, despite the fact that it could be used for storing people's images, and, you know, people are worried about invasions of privacy and improper use of that surveillance information. But we're trying to get them because it's been shown that some officers lie in their reports, and they write, which is something that is very much untrue. And then they can go back and watch the video before they submit the report, and then they can kind of tailor the responses accordingly so they don't look as bad. One of the big challenges is that the union did not want the officers to write the reports first, but wanted them to be able to see any footage from body-worn cameras before they submit their reports. And they say that that will ensure that they write a good report. Now, here's one of the challenges an officer has, especially if you're in a jurisdiction that has a shortage of officers. If they're running from call to call, and somewhere in the middle of the day, they have something that is really problematic. Excessive use of force or questionable tactics or something like that. And something that they have to write a detailed report on. If they're going from call to call, they may not remember all of the really important details. So you have people who feel like, well, that makes perfect sense that they could watch the video first and then write the report. But that flies in the face of what we have seen, you know, in terms of evidence that more often than not, what had happened was not what they had initially wanted to report. And if the camera captures something that they report that is, you know, different, if there's some incongruencies, we'll be able to catch them. And it gives a more balanced or impartial view of what actually happened as opposed to what the officer says happens.
And a couple of points, Celeste, on this. First, the City Council on Thursday did approve of the contract unanimously.
Yeah, okay.
And the two sides also failed to reach mutual terms on the body camera policy.
Yes, indeed.
The City Council, you know, voted earlier, you know, as you told us, to allow Portland to start buying body cameras, but that policy would dictate their use have yet to be hammered out. And, you know, the police union was insistent on pre-review. The city and other civil rights people in the Department of Justice has said that is unacceptable. And instead prefer a policy requiring officers, as you told us, to write their report first. Then, if necessary, produce an addendum reports after viewing body cameras. They did not reach an agreement on that. What happens now? Where does that leave us? In terms of they will not use body cameras until the an agreement, or?
Now that's a good question. That's something that we'll have to do some digging to find out. And I imagine that some of the folks involved might be playing the cards kind of close, you know. So I mean I can like a lot of us, I can ask around to find out what's going on. A lot of us can call up the commissioner and the mayor, the commissioners involved in the mayor, and query and ask, you know. They have staff that will reflect this. You can send them emails and ask what's next, because we really do need to have some resolution to this. Because right now the feeling of being protected and served is pretty low, you know. It's miraculously low. It's appallingly low, but
yeah,
we need each other.
And the contract, you know, I think both sides can point to areas of concerns that they got into the contract. The police union secured retention bonuses and mm-hmm. incentives and pay hikes for its members, while the city secured terms to expand the Portland Street Response Team, clarify the terms of officers' outside employment, and also reach agreement on a discipline guide that will be in the contract. So there were things that both sides in the negotiation could point to as wins, but no one got everything they wanted, as in that's true in life. But the police union overwhelmingly voted a couple of weeks ago in favor of the contract, and the city council unanimously approved it.
So it is ratified, yeah.
So.
Good, good, good.
Good, good, good.
What's next? Like you said, 503-231-8187. Join us here at More Talk Radio. Oh, I said it right.
There you go. There you
I got
go.
My days right. So, you know, I want to be optimistic. And we've had some challenges already. I mean, even though the issue with we talked about this, I guess, 3 weeks ago or so, about the training resource that had the really offensive material in it, you know, and yeah, that's 3 years old, you know. The point is, we're dealing with a force of people, and an interesting word that we use, force of people, but we're dealing with a force that has some power and that it has inflicted damage before, and we want to build a relationship that removes all of those points of harm and dishonesty, you know, and create something that really reflects more of a protect and serve, and the idea that we used to have back in the day of, you know, police that were helpful and would stop and play basketball with the kids and, you know, be helpful in the community in other ways. Kind of like the whole, what do you call it? I don't want to say, well, the whole idea of how firefighters, you know, are seen as community heroes. And people want to revive or recreate that whole persona again for officers, but we just are so polarized nowadays. It doesn't seem like it's even possible. And it almost seems naive to dream that way.
Yes, it does. It does, in terms of being what is real and what is not real.
Well, but give us a call, you know, because Cecil and I will talk, and you don't really want to just sit here and hear us tell you what we think. We want to have a discussion with you. And even if it's not really that sexy, like I said, it's something that's going to affect the community. And people should get their ideas and thoughts out and also figure out where they can go to connect with other like-minded folks and where they can go to get their to share their concerns and their ideas. So again, 503-231-8187.
And again, the two topics we proffered this morning is the Portland Police contract. What are your thoughts about it? Where do we go from here? And the nomination of Judge Kentaji Brown Jackson for the U.S. Supreme Court. And if she is, actually she is the first black woman to have been nominated for the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, you know, those are the things that Celeste and I offer, but, you know, I think we would be less than honest that over all of us these past few days have been the situation in Europe.
Yes.
Be hard to ignore. And the fact that there is war in Europe and the antagonist, not the antagonist, I'd say the aggressor is is Russia, who has placed, had let it be known that they have raised the level of concerns and raised their nuclear level awareness. So over all of us, who for many of us who thought like 30 years ago, with the so-called end of the Cold War and the liberation of the republics and the former Soviet Union, with the nuclear arms agreement in the 80s and 90s.
Or just the fall of the Soviet Union.
That we were entering into a new world, a new safer world. And the reality is that as long as we are living under the threat of war and nuclear weapons, things are terrible. And the fact that, you know, for the first time in what 70 or 80 years, there is war in Europe. And the fact that There are thousands of refugees. It's a time of heightened concerns. Again, our numbers are 503-231-8187. And let's hear what Robbie has to say this morning. Good morning, Robbie.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, I just wanted to talk about the Ukrainian thing. I was really listening to everything else that you had mentioned, and it was very, we'll see where that goes. But I wanted to bring up the Ukrainian thing because I feel like I'm kind of in a different place. I have a much different take of kind of what's happening with Ukraine. Uh-huh. But, you know, just hear me out, I guess, because, like, you know, I just want to figure out where it is that I might be wrong. But in 2014, there was Zelensky, who was backed by Western and NATO people who, along with the mayor of Kyiv, were a part of this Petro Party, which was recently created. Mm-hmm. And with the Burisma Energy Department, we fired a prosecutor because we felt like they weren't right. We installed our own, under of which is Joe Biden's son. There's the Nord Stream pipeline that was going to be providing Russian gas to Eastern Europe and Germany. And now that's all up in the, like, that's what I'm seeing is a lot of other things than just Putin deciding to be a bully, which is what everybody's saying. What I see is like 20 years of Cold War-esque, you know, resource grabbing, and I see Russia backed up against the wall. And I'm not apologizing for any imperialism. I think both governments are a cancer that are growing on the human race. But what I'm seeing is this idea that war is peace, and, oh, if only we could help Ukraine, why are we leaving them out? And it's like, we're not helping Ukraine. We've literally armed them. Mm-hmm. We sent 10,000 troops to their border last month. We sent 10,000 troops to their border. And I'm just sitting here, and I'm listening to everybody repeat, oh, Putin's a bully, which is literally word for word what, you know, Joe Biden in the State Department is saying. And I just don't buy it. I don't think that we're in it because Putin's just a bully. I think that NATO has been expanding eastward. And I think we tried installing Zelensky, who was actually a Ukrainian television actor, before he got backed by Western and NATO alliances and installed into their government. So
given,
I think there's
this,
a lot of information.
Yeah, given. No, I'll let you finish that, and then I want you to. I have a question for you. Go ahead.
Sure, I'll finish with this one last point. But if you look at a month ago, even Zelensky and the Prime Minister of Defense were saying that America was creating the panic, we were stirring this controversy, and we were arming the Ukrainians, which are neo-Nazis, by the way. You know, I'm sitting here and I'm just confused because I see war as peace. And so, my point was is that the president and the prime minister of defense were saying over a month ago that Russia was not a threat, but America was. And so I'm just confused. I'm really cautious to believe that the same president that we have right now, who was the main pusher of the Iraq war with the weapons of mass destruction, he was the main pusher next to Dick Cheney for that war. And I'm just having a hard time believing that Putin's just deciding to be this bully all of a sudden. I think that there's a lot more at stake that Americans are not paying into attention to.
So what is at stake, and more specifically, we could have philosophical arguments about the cause or why certain individuals are in positions of power. But given the reality that tens of thousands of Ukrainian citizens are fleeing their country, and that there is a push by the Soviet Union to, by their military, to move into the country, what do you see as a solution to this crisis?
First of all, I wouldn't call it the Soviet Union. I don't know if that's the correct word for what
Russia
is.
Russia.
And I would say that might be the... I'd say it somewhat with tongue in cheek, but Russia, you're correct.
Well, it's a Red Scare is really what's happened. And I mean, this has been happening. What happened? I mean, and here's the thing, like, yeah, war is awful, and that's their fleeing. There was war in there in 2014. You know, Ukraine was shelling the same exact regions. And so, you know, I don't think war is ever good. I don't think America helping out is any better. And that's where I stand. I'm looking at America's involvement in arming Ukraine. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at not only that, but there was on Democracy Now, they were talking about Lockheed Martin and Boeing. These war manufacturers are talking about the great investment opportunities we have with you know, Ukraine. There is over $700 billion spent in Ukraine leading up to this war from American interests. Which I think is what we need to be paying attention to if we're going to be talking about, oh, Putin's such a bully. Well, America was there was there provoking this bully. You know, what do you have when you have two, you know, people going at it like that? You know, and I just think that this whole thing is a little bit skewed, that Russia's a bully when literally America just cut off their resources that they had literally, they finished building this Nord Stream pipeline.
And we could continue to have this philosophical, you know, discussion in terms of origins, but for me, it remaining, what is your suggestion in terms of response for the apparent terror that is causing, you know, tens of thousands of Ukrainian citizens to flee from their country?
Look,
it's not an existential argument. The reality, if that's your family, what do you say?
What do I say if it's my family?
Yeah, I mean, it's the reality. It's, you know, people are concerned about their family members who are living in terror right now. What is the response for them to live in safety?
Well, I mean, I guess, you know, I don't know, but I don't know if, like, sending military troops, you know, 10,000 American troops there helps them out at all. So I don't know, you know, what the solution is, but it looks like in terms of who the aggressor was, I would say that's America.
Okay, so you have a good analysis, but you don't have a suggestion about how to stop the existential fear and angst that ordinary people such as you and I are experiencing right now.
I think I'm just trying to provide a perspective of, like, a larger thing, and it's like, yeah, right now it's too late. I mean, right now Zelensky, and in 2014 we had overthrown their energy department and installed our people that were controlling them politically, and so I don't think there was any.
So the suggestion is, you know, folks, you know, there's nothing we can do, you know.
Maybe Putin's actually justified because we're the bad guys, is what I hear.
Well, no, I'm not trying. I think that both nation states are bad guys, and I think both are creating this war. I think that when we say that Russia was the lone aggressor, that we are not paying attention to the larger issue of things, which is this geopolitical energy fight. Same exact reason with why we're in Syria. But people all beat the war's peace drum saying that, oh, Assad gassed his own people, when that was actually a lie fabricated. And we were fighting about the what's called the friendship pipeline. Russia and America were fighting over this pipeline, where it was going to go. And if you look up the friendship pipeline, it's from Iran, Syria. And that's when the Syrian civil war broke out, right when they stopped that pipeline. So what I'm seeing is the same pattern of, oh, there's this, oh, Russia's attacking Ukraine just out of the blue. Why are they doing that? Oh, they just decided to randomly do this? Oh, no, there's a pipeline involved. There's energy. There's money. There's so much more to it that I think people should be paying attention to if we're going to start sitting here and pointing fingers at who's actually doing it.
So thank you so much for your analysis. I think it's really important. And my pushback wasn't that I necessarily disagree with you, but it was from an existential question. People are suffering right now, and we can have our philosophical arguments. What do you tell about, what do you say to the family who don't know what tomorrow will bring? What do we say?
I'm terribly sorry. I'm sorry you're in this position where you're stuck between two fighting powers for control of resources, which is beyond, which is why I'm an anti-war activist in the first place, and why I'm trying to, like, you know, get beyond this world of control and, you know, imperialist, or, you know, however we see it, this authoritarian government, which is a cancer on our human species. Unless we can identify it properly, I don't think we're going to ever, because right now we're just supporting and we're apologizing for America, which is blowing up Somalia, by the way. We are targeting, we are doing airstrikes in Somalia as we speak, but nobody seems to be talking about those countries of, you know what I'm saying here?
Yeah, I do. Mm-hmm. And again, I don't disagree.
What about
disagree
the Yemen?
With,
what about the Yemeni? Hey, what about the Yemeni?
Yemen, yeah.
And the genocide, which the UN is characterizing as a genocide, the worst humanitarian crisis ever. What about that?
So let me. I mean, that's my question. I mean, in terms of what do we do in response to these crises? We can, you know, we haven't even talked about the climate crises we're in.
Yes.
I mean, and there's realities are that there are people and the planets are suffering, and, you know, we can have these philosophical debates, but are there things that we can do, or isn't really anything we can do that to make things different? So, you know, do the best you can, and maybe you'll survive, maybe you won't. You know, maybe we can't make existential change, but are there humanitarian efforts? Should we ignore those, or what can we do?
No.
Should we help, you know, no. Doctors Without Borders? Or, I mean,
I'll finish with this, and I know it's a very interesting and very hard concept, but I just think that knowledge is power.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that those who control history, or those who control our past and our information, are able to control our future. So I think it's important for us to spread, you know, the knowledge and the history of what's actually happened, so we have better ways of informing ourselves and agreeing with war, or being okay with, you know, installing regime change of whatever nation state it might be, because I think that there's repercussions that are always much worse that we find out about afterwards, whenever it's like, oh yeah, Halliburton was making money, there were no WMDs, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hey, thank you so much,
Robbie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would say I'm not in Ukraine, and my spot and my perspective is totally not in theirs, obviously, but when I'm looking at it from this standpoint, I want to share that information. That's all.
That's great.
Okay.
It's good. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for sharing your information.
Thank you.
Tony's next. Numbers are 503-231-8187. And Celeste, should we go to Tony?
Yeah. Well, I wanted to say a few things, but let's give Tony a shot. Let's not keep him holding.
Okay.
Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I'm glad you're talking about this. I just have a comment to make. Cecil, I appreciate you coming back to the question, what do we do? I think what he's doing is exactly what needs to be done right now, is most people are not educated in what is going on to even get to the point where they can even figure out what to do. So I think the step he's doing is crucial right now, because you just don't hear it anywhere. Mm-hmm. Except on KABU. If there's any solution, I think, is the U.S. just has to pull out and let Ukraine and Russia work this out, and maybe in the background with diplomacy, but I don't even trust that, actually, with Tony Blinken in there. So that's all I have to say. I don't know if you... I'll take your response off the air, okay?
Oh. Okay, but thank you, Tony.
Uh-huh.
Go ahead, Tony.
I want to touch on a few things that Robbie said. You know, it is true that the U.S. has been, I don't want to say a shadow partner or a silent partner, with these dealings with the petrol, and people call them the petrol oligarchs or the petrol thugs or the petrol whatever, mm-hmm. You know, but these folks fighting over the resources. And I know that when Russia was involved with what was it, the pipeline, he called it the Friendship Pipeline. It had another name. Let me look that up real quick. It starts with a D. What was it? Well, anyway, I'll call it the first. Oh, the Druzhba Pipeline. That's what I remembered. So anyway, it's not like we weren't involved. And he's right. We do need to understand that there's nuance to all of these conflicts, you know, and it's not as though somebody just decided that they're going to go off and try to annex yet another piece of somebody else's land. There's much more to the story. I do get that, but I also feel like it's important that we understand that, but it's like you said, what are we going to do? How do we figure out what to do? And it's almost as though, you know, the problem has been created so that it pulls us in two different opposing directions at the same time, which causes kind of like a paralysis. Uh-huh. So people don't know what to do because they're thinking, well, if I support Ukraine, am I not supporting the U.S.? Or if I support Russia, am I not supporting the U.S. and not being nice to Ukraine, you know, and not recognizing that sometimes these kinds of conflicts are created so that it causes this socio-political paralysis.
Right. Thank you. That's helpful because that's often where I think we find ourselves in that socio-political paralysis. And I think when we find ourselves in that spot, then we are, for lack of a better term, have been defeated.
Yeah.
Because there is no action whatsoever. And, you know, and that's disappointing. And I appreciate what Robbie said, which, you know, among the things I appreciated what Robbie said, what they said, were that, you know, there are crises all around the world, and there mm-hmm. are wars that are there because of you as political military action.
Mm-hmm.
And that the pawns in these wars are individuals and societies who were not at the table, so-called table, when these decisions were made. So we have crises in Syria, Yemen. It's another horrible story. The wars in Africa and the conflicts in Central and South America
yes.
continue.
Mm-hmm.
And
not to mention just the stuff we're dealing here with domestically.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And also put this all in the context of the climate crises that as we march into a climate death, what do we do to move beyond paralysis? And part of the pushback I was saying, and I just threw up Doctors Without Borders, are there things we can do in the interim to give some relief, not to necessarily solve these socio-political crises, but to give some relief to those who are the immediate victims of war and our antagonistic view towards protecting the climate.
Or, you know, absorbing resources. You know, what I want to say is the first thing I think we need to realize, and I'm trying to figure out how I can break this down and not involve too much code switching. But basically, in my mind, this whole dilemma is created by a variation of a Hegelian dialectic, okay, in which you create a problem and then you create a solution. And the problem is artificially created to further some agenda or dynamic. And the solution also hastens on that same plan that you have, and people react because you tug on something that is resonant with them, and they react, and in their reaction they themselves choose the solution you want them to choose for the problem that you created to further your goal. And I feel like this is kind of a spin on that. And that's one reason why I use that word or that phrase, sociopolitical paralysis. Yeah. You know, because I believe that it is created to do this very thing. And people will say, well, Celeste, that would mean that you believe that people have these great plans and conspiracies and these far-reaching agendas. And it's like, yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you stop and think about what some of the wars that we have fought, what those people who, those antagonists, they looked at, what was the phrase? World domination. So this is not hyperbole. It's not. I'm not like blowing it all out of proportion. I'm actually trying to get people to look at the scope of this. You know, we're suffering right now from fatigue, because not only do we have, music and popular art and TV that kind of dumbs us down and feeds us, you know, whatever pabulum they want to give us, but there are a lot of things out of our control. But the one thing we can control is how we respond to them. But our response mechanisms are so skewed that we find ourselves arguing about, well, do you give aid to the Ukrainian people or do you give aid to the Russian people? You know, and it's like, how about we give aid to the people? Yeah. And a really good example of this is what's happening many times, not only in Central America, but in a lot of the African countries, you know, where you're having these conflicts. Everybody needs aid. You know, what you need is to find out what has motivated the common person to want to fight their neighbor and find out those values. Okay, well, that's on a low level, Celeste. That doesn't matter. Yeah, it does matter, because we here on the low level are the ones that are fighting.
Well, I think,
and taking each other's lives.
Yeah, you know, I appreciate what you said, because it helps me understand that perhaps there are things that we can do. You know, part of the challenge personally I face is that sometimes I have to move out of my head and deal with the reality that's in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in recent last couple of years, globally, we've been dealing with this pandemic.
Yeah.
And what we've seen unfold in our nation and throughout the world is how discussion about this pandemic has created silos of people, of opinions, which makes it difficult to have any meaningful conversation.
And conversation with nuance.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
While at the same time, you know, thousands of people are getting sick, hospitalized, and dying.
Yeah.
And we can have these philosophical arguments, political arguments, but perhaps maybe I don't know why, but I also see it's important, what do we do right now to that with that person or community that's suffering? It may not be a solution which is saves the world,
mm-hmm.
or but what can you do in terms of giving comfort to those who are suffering?
Well, you know, I want to support you asking that question and making us come back to that. I know some people will say, well, that's kind of elementary, yeah. You know, and it's more of a palliative, you know, something to make us feel good rather than it actually has profound curative powers. But here's the thing. It's important that we think in terms of how do we render aid? Because number one, these are people just like us. You know, they are human beings. And that's often how you create that connection, that bridge, that communication, wherein people start having a change of heart.
Yes.
You know, so I really think, yeah, we have to. We have to go to the ground floor and put on our oxygen masks. But we have one more caller I think we can get in. Good morning, Liz. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning, and thank you so much for this program. And I'm really just appreciate so much the perspective that Robbie gave and the room that you gave him to express it, and the other caller as well. And I feel like the most important thing we have to face here is voting rights and poverty, and that this war takes our attention away from the most important things we have to face here. And it just doesn't seem to me like that's just an accident. But if something to do is voting rights, I mean, I don't see we're going to have a democracy here if we don't do something about that. And this compassion for people under war, and yet it's, as they were saying, it's all around the world. So
yeah.
Again, thank you so much. And I would love to see, and our poor homeless people here, it's a tragedy, you know. Mm-hmm. It's not a choice, it's just a tragedy. Okay, thank you.
Well, thank you for your call.
Thank you for sharing with us. Yeah.
You know, and I totally agree. It's things like worried about how we're going to respond to homelessness, a lot of the shootings going on, et cetera, et cetera, that keep us so fatigued and paralyzed, because it's just too much, and the human psyche is we're resilient, but we're also fragile, you know.
Yeah.
It's an interesting balance.
Well, I wonder, you know, you mentioned in terms of keeps up fatigue and unable to act.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder, I'm thinking now that perhaps, you know, we, you know, however you want to characterize, cannot do everything.
We can't.
And as the last caller just shared in terms of, you know, the issue of voting rights and poverty, mm-hmm. and that's so important. And if you heard Democracy Now, I think it was Democracy Now, something I heard this morning was talking about how Texas has started their primary and how many ballots have been cast out because, you know, just of these Republican new voting rules.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that I would like to encourage people, wherever their passion lies, to do that, whether it's working on voting rights, whether it is in mutual aid groups,
mm-hmm.
Handing out things for people who are living on the street, whether it is having a good analysis on geopolitical issues and organizing for transformation, whether it is working on the climate crises, whether it is working with the animal shelter, all of it is important, and what you do is important for the redemption of creation.
Yeah, I was going to go back and just say what I think it was Robbie, or maybe it was Tony, said the species, redemption of the species, you know, but redemption of creation.
And all of all of those things are important. And, you know, I think we can cry and ought to cry about how we are unable to do everything and try to find the root causes of these things. And that's so very important. But wherever your passion lies, I think that is what you should do. and knowing that you are doing what you are called to do, and the universe, I think, will work it out at some point.
Well, we hope so. And, you know, on a minor scale, even though it was not necessarily the best contract we could have had, the mere fact that we had two polarized groups, as the Portland Police Union and the City of Portland, even have a tentative agreement, it's a good thing.
Yeah, it's an agreement.
It's an agreement. It's a start. Yeah. You know, it's not the end all, and it's not perfect, but it's communication. And when you're rendering aid to somebody, regardless of what, you know, side they're on, you're communicating, and you're communicating hope. Well, this is Monday, so we laid down the pattern for communicating hope.
Okay.
We may not have solved any problems, but we said, hey, still keep building those bridges and those roads and extending a hand. And speaking of extending a hand, don't forget to extend a hand to your community connection, KBOO. You can text the letters KBOO to the numbers 44321, or you can go online to kboo.fm and you can click donate now, or you can send a check to KBOO 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214, and keep strong community building communication on the air. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
What would KBOO be without its more than 300 volunteers? They support the station with everything, and now they need someone to support them. KBOO is looking for a community.